Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning, everyone. It's 4 minutes after the hour, Thursday, August 10th. In 1821, Missouri became the 24th state. Did I say that right? Missouri.
Depends on where you are in the state, I think.
I suppose that does make a difference, doesn't it?
Up north, it's Missouri.
But in the south, it's Missouri. Missouri. There we go. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So, inflatable chicken near the White House resembles Donald Trump. Nice segue, huh?
That was beautiful.
Thank you so much. A giant inflatable chicken is taking roost next to the White House. The 24-foot chicken sporting President Trump's hairstyle was seen yesterday in an open area to the public. The design mimics a statue unveiled at a Chinese shopping center last year. Trump missed the chicken across the road as he's taking a working vacation at his New Jersey golf resort. I just want to speak to all you golfers out there. How cool is this as far as getting a tee time? I'm the president of the United States, and I own the golf course. I think I'm getting the tee time I want. That's every golfer's dream come true. You just call the starter and you say, this is when I'm showing up. Have the first tee ready. That'd be nice. Now, are Christians more likely to blame a person's poverty on lack of effort? And the study says, no, they're more than twice as likely to blame people. So we're going to talk to Dr. Ann Bradley about that. And of course, there's some reasons to suggest that you shouldn't be lazy or slothful. That's certainly a part of it. But there's also something to do with maybe the situation. Maybe it's the poverty might be the sins of others and not of the person who is poor. So we're going to talk to Dr. Ann Rathbone Bradley, one of my favorite economists in the whole world. And before we go to a break, it's also Ian Anderson's 70th birthday today. And if you're like me and had a little penchant for 70s rock, you're going to remember the band Jethro Tull. They're still around. Let's play a little of Tull as we head into our break. If you sit this one out,
my words but a whisper, your deafness a shout. I may make you feel, but I can't make you think. Your sperm's in the gutter, your love's in the sink.
Welcome back to the show. So glad you're with us today. One of our favorite guests is Ann Bradley. She is with the Institute for Faith, Works, and Economics. And an interesting article came out recently that said, are Christians more than twice as likely to blame a person's poverty on a lack of effort? So if you're living in poverty and you're a Christian, are you going to be pointing fingers? So I thought we'd bring Ann on to talk about that. Ann, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks. I was in a meeting here at the station the other day, and a colleague leans over and says, "You know who your best guest is?" I said, "Who?" She said, "Ann Bradley."
Aw, did you have to pay her to say that?
I slipped her $20.
Oh, good. Thank you for doing that.
So now I got to get that money from you.
That's exactly right. We can work out an arrangement.
All right, so let's talk about laziness. Now, we know what the Bible says, so maybe Christians have that attitude because we look at a Proverb 10, and it says, a slack hand causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. So don't we look and say, all right, there's a reason we think this way.
Absolutely. That is what I was thinking when I read this article about the survey that came out, is you can go to Proverbs and read a lot about our responsibility to be industrious, our responsibility to work hard with what we've got. And we also know that even if we don't have a lot to offer God, he'll take what we offer him. And so, you know, I think what that means is we're not all going to have maybe Bill Gates type of talent, but God will bless us if we work hard. And so it seems kind of easy and black and white to say, well, if people are poor, it's probably because they're not working hard. And we certainly know that sin brings poverty. So in the garden, you can imagine the world as God has created it, and you have Adam and Eve in There's no sin yet. There's no poverty in that world.
Right.
So poverty is certainly associated with the fall and with sin, but I think it's a little bit more nuanced than maybe we want to believe, and maybe what this survey demonstrates, that poverty is not always the result of your own sin. Sure, there are people who are poor because they made bad financial decisions, or they have addictions, or things like this. But there are also real reasons for poverty that are beyond an individual's control. And so our solutions to poverty have to take account of that.
Yeah, and let's talk about the complexities of poverty, because I don't know if we really understand it very well. I mean, I sometimes have heard if you give a person in poverty $100,000, a year later they're still going to be back in poverty.
Yeah, I mean, you hear that a lot, and I agree with you that we need to peel the onion, as they say, and think about why people are poor. And that's going to have very individual reasons and responses to it. And so, somebody even living in Detroit or Baltimore or the inner, kind of ghetto of L.A. somewhere, we might see people who on the outside look the same. They live outside or they live in their car and they don't have access to the goods and services that they need.
Mm-hmm.
But those people who are in the same city or the same town could be poor for quite very different reasons. And certainly the people that are poor in Detroit are probably poor for different reasons than the people in modern day Venezuela are poor. And so it's a very kind of specific and individual thing. And we have to really look at, well, why is it that you might give somebody $100,000 and it's gone in a year? Well, I think it's because our aid efforts tend to be what I call parachute. We kind of parachute in with help and we leave. And the problem is that poverty is not just material, it's spiritual and relational. So we really want to help, for example, the addict. Maybe they've lost their home and lost everything. They're living on the street. If we want to help that person, just dropping $100,000 in cash on them is not going to help them. It might hurt them, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
They might use more, right? So what we would need to do is get into a relationship. And what does this person need beyond just food for today? They need the gospel. They need counseling. They need maybe vocational training or more education. There's a lot of things that they need. So to really help that person permanently transition out of poverty, that's going to be a long walk. It's not just the parachute aid.
Mm-hmm. So, Anne, if we try to look for the clues that points Christians to being maybe more critical of people in poverty, we look at the passage in Thessalonians where Jesus says, the one who is unwilling to work shall not eat. Well, Jesus didn't say that, but I think Paul did. But then also Jesus said, the poor you will always have with you. So in other words, poverty and poor is going to be a fact of life. And if you're not willing to eat or to work, you shall not eat. So I can see where Christians are going to start to build the case for their attitudes towards poverty.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think you're right to point out both of those passages because it gets to our responsibility. God created us each with a purpose. We're each given talents. We're image bearers, which means we're creators. I think that's both inspiring and humbling, but there's a lot of weight that goes along with that. There's a lot we have to do. We have a lot of responsibility to being made in the image of God, and we can't take that lightly. We have to work hard. It's very clear. But you're right to point out the Matthew passage, which is the poor you will always have with you. You won't always have me. And I think what that gets to, in the light of living in the 21st century, the numbers would say something very different. The numbers would say, well, you're not always going to have abject poverty with you. But I think what that verse really means is not just material poverty. We'll always have spiritual poverty because we live in a fallen world. And until Jesus returns and restores the earth and redeems it, you're right, it's a fact of life. And so people might continue, and I think they will continue across the globe to get richer and richer and richer. And I think abject poverty will truly be a thing of the past. But that doesn't mean we've wiped sin off the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that people won't fall on hard times. And so I think we have to take both of those verses into kind of the way we think about how do we help people? How do we help the poor? It's not just giving cash and running away. And what do we do when people aren't poor anymore materially?
Mm-hmm.
What do we do then? It doesn't mean that we don't have a spiritual battle that we're fighting. I think the poverty there is much more than just material. The Bible deals with spiritual and material poverty. And really, material poverty, frankly, is in some ways easy, right? Because it's easy to kind of figure out in a market-based economy how people can get jobs and work hard. What's harder is convincing people and spreading the gospel in an increasingly hostile world. So that job will always be upon us. And I think that's what that Matthew verse is about. It's about both types of poverty.
We're going to continue this conversation after the break. I'm speaking to Dr. Ann Bradley from the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. We'll take a short break and be right back. Welcome back to the show. So glad you're with us today. We're talking to Dr. Ann Bradley from the Institute of Faith, Works, and Economics. And we're talking about today the idea that Christians are more than twice as likely to blame a person's poverty on lack of effort. And obviously, as we're having this discussion with Ann, the complexities of poverty are not the easiest to understand. And there has been a lot of finger-pointing going on, and many people's beliefs on the question doesn't necessarily have to do with faith, because there was a fall in the Garden of Eden, and gosh, they were not poor at all, were they?
Not at all. Not at all. And I think, you know, what I'd like to bring up here in this debate, because these numbers are really striking, as you say, two-thirds, you know, of particularly if you segmented out white evangelical Christians. So if you go that nuanced in the data, mm-hmm. Then there's a strong tendency to blame it on lack of effort. And here's why I think it's maybe not unreasonable, if someone hasn't thought about the problem deeply, to say that. I think the reason it's not unreasonable for someone maybe to say that is, well, gosh, I have a house and I work hard and I have to pay my bills and I have to pay my credit card bills and it's hard, but I do it. So if I can do it and I'm an ordinary person, why can't everybody do it?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think we have kind of this bias about our own lives. We say, well, I'm doing it. It's a struggle. It's hard, but I'm doing it. So everybody else should be able to do it. And this gets us to a conversation that I think needs to be involved with this study, is the war on poverty. I mean, is the war on poverty making it easier for ordinary people to not be poor, or is it making it harder? And we've been waging this war on poverty for over 50 years. It started with Lyndon Johnson, and we really haven't moved the needle at all. But what we have done is created a lot of institutions at the federal and the state and the local level that create incentives for people who are poor. And Marvin Alasky is really the expert on this.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a book called, you know, The Tragedy of American Compassion. And it was about welfare and the welfare reform battle of the 90s. And basically what he says is, really, we destroyed families by making it possible for single moms to keep having babies. And actually, the way you got more benefits was to keep having more babies. And if you got married, your benefits were less. So what kind of signal does that send? What kind of incentive does it establish? I mean, you know, we have to really think about the institutions around battling poverty. So I think it's unfair to say that, well, it's just lack of effort. I think people get trapped in the system and they're just responding to the incentives that are given to them. And certainly if they don't have the gospel, why, you know, how would they even know that those aren't good ideas? That the family is sacred and, you know, you need two parents and you need a loving relationship. If people don't have the gospel, why would they think that? So again, I think we need a lot more nuance in this conversation in saying, you know, are these institutions that have been established to fight poverty actually part of the problem? And it seems that they are.
Yeah, great point. And how do we develop compassion for the poor if we're feeling this way towards them? If we're going, well, if you worked harder, you wouldn't be so poor. So how do we develop compassion for them in a way that actually helps restore their dignity?
Yeah, this is such a beautiful question, because I think we need to look at every person, whether they're in our neighborhood, in a city in the United States or far from the United States. These are people who are fellow human beings, made in the image of God, precious in his sight. And when we start to think about people that way, it's harder to kind of just say, well, you know, you're not working hard, or, well, you know, you didn't make the right choices. Certainly that's the case often. But I think if we look at people the way Jesus looks at us, then it's much easier for us to have compassion and to say, this is a fellow human being, and it's possible it could be me one day, and how would I want to be treated if I fell upon bad times and I had no familial safety net, and mm-hmm. I was living on the street. So I think we need to view people the way Jesus views each of us, and realize that they are precious. They have something to offer, and often what they need is a relationship, and that's what Jesus provides us. That's what we need to provide others. So I think the model of Jesus here is the only way to go.
Mm-hmm. So I think it was Clarence Thomas who asked his dad once, and he said, "Dad, how come you never went on an entitlement program of any kind?" And he said, "Because they take away your manhood." So as we try to help restore people's dignity who might be suffering in poverty, let's use one of your favorite words and say, how do we go so we can encourage them to be flourishing?
Yes. Yes. And I think it's realizing that that's such a great story. But I don't want my dignity taken away from me. And it's not intentional. The people who are working in these poverty relief programs are not evil. But the system is broken, and it perpetuates despair rather than flourishing. So you're right. I think, we have to look at each individual human being as a unique creation of God and say we want to protect their dignity. And you can't protect somebody's dignity if you walk by them and throw cash at them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just makes us kind of feel momentarily better. I helped someone. If we really want to help in the long run, we have to know the people we're helping.
Mm-hmm.
We absolutely have to get into relationship if we want to fight this long road of poverty. It's not just about, everybody has a smartphone in their house or, a TV, so everybody's good. No, again, that's the spiritual war that we're fighting in tandem with this material war.
Mm-hmm. How do we fight that trigger in our brain that comes to a snap conclusion when we see somebody in poverty or in a situation where we want to make a quick judgment about them? How do we shut that off?
Gosh, maybe we need to all take a break from social media. I'm not sure what the answer, myself included. We live in a world of 86 character tweets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a terrible thing. I think that social media is a good thing and can be helpful for people. But I think that we want instant gratification all the time. We want simple solutions to difficult problems. And we lack nuanced and critical thinking. So this is kind of the standard I try to hold up in my classroom is there aren't easy answers to the hardest problems, because if there were easy answers, we wouldn't have the hard problems.
Mm-hmm.
We would have solved them. And so we have to really be thoughtful and careful when we're talking about problems where human beings are concerned.
Yeah.
So I think that's the first advice I would give, is just we have to have a lot of thoughtfulness and care, and it's just not knee-jerk reactions aren't helpful.
Yeah. And you're a Christian and an economist, and just with less than a minute to go, if there is someone standing at the street corner with their hand out or a cup out towards you, is it a good idea to give them a little money?
I think it can be, but I would always accompany that with a conversation. And I think if you don't have time for the conversation, you have to use your best judgment. And so I don't always know what the right answer there is, but I would always say, make the time for a conversation, and make the time for more conversations if you can. It doesn't have to be an hour. It can be a few minutes, because I think as human beings, that's what we long for. We long to be loved by others. We long for relationships.
Yeah. Well, and like my colleague, she's so right. You are just one of our very best guests that comes on the show. Thank you so much for being
so nice. Thank you.
And so smart. And I just love having you on the program.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Bill.
Thanks. All right. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Yep. That's Dr. Ann Bradley from the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. We'll take a short break and be back with more of the show.
Don't share your email address with anyone. We think. We're not very good with the technological stuff. Join us on the Early Morning Late Show on Faith Radio.
It is 4:30. We're going to take a news break, and then when we come back at 2:20, we're going to talk to Dr. David Aikman, the gold standard for foreign affairs, public policy. Can't wait to have him on the line and get his take on what's going on in North Korea. We'll be back in just a minute.
Never changes our faith.
Good morning. 25 minutes until the top of the hour. Author and ministry leader Johnny Erickson Tata says she chooses to focus on God's grace and mercy every day and reminds us that His love and presence is available to everyone.
Yesterday, my hip was really hurting, and I had to ask my girls here at the office, my coworkers, to please come into the restroom and, you know, adjust my corset, loosen this, tighten that, adjust my leg, pull my hip over. And while they were doing that, I was singing, "All the way my Savior leads me, cheers each winding path I tread, gives me grace for every trial, feeds me on the living bread." And that's how I keep the focus during the day, no matter if it's pain in this wheelchair or a deep disappointment in life or a challenge that I don't feel I'm able to meet. I often turn to, obviously, memorized scriptures, but also memorized hymns and praise music and worship songs. The words to these worship songs and hymns are so powerful. Many of them are packed with great doctrine of the faith. And so I think it's a way of praying without ceasing, going through the day and doing as Ephesians tells us to do, sing and make melody in your heart to the Lord. It's a wonderful way to keep your focus on the author and the perfecter of your faith hour by hour.
I didn't see that coming. When she started singing, my blood pressure dropped 9 points. I monitor it 24/7. Anyway, that was really nice, really sweet. That, of course, was Johnny Erickson Tata, author and founder of Johnny and Friends. You hear that regularly here on the station. If you want to hear that entire interview and hear that singing again, like me, you go to myfaithradio.com and type in Fixing Eyes on the King, Johnny Erickson Tata. That will take you to that interview. You know, for many years when the New York Yankees were in a tense situation in the ninth inning, who did they call? They called Mariano Rivera. So when there's a tense situation in the world, who do I call? Of course, Dr. David Aikman. He's up next.
To think that a teenager could become so hopeless that he would choose to end his life is almost too painful to imagine. But with the increasing rate of teen suicides, no parent can afford to ignore the possibility. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. For teens, suicide is a last-ditch effort to ease the pain, to make a statement, or to get revenge on someone who's wronged them. They can't see the bigger picture. They can only see the here and now. Short-sighted immaturity mixed with feelings of despair are a lethal combination. So if your son or daughter has been dropping subtle hints, like talking about death or isolating themselves from others, don't ignore the warning signs. Get your teen the help they need before they become another statistic.
For more parenting tips from Mark Gregston, go to parentingtodaysteens.org. That's parentingtodaysteens.org.
My name is Bond, James Bond.
That, of course, is the theme song to Dr. David Aikman. And, of course, he says the Bond, James Bond part in the middle. That was him himself doing that. He is the gold standard for political analysis. And on the Early Morning Late Show, he is on my personal Mount Rushmore. David, good morning.
Good morning to you, Bill. Thank you so much for having me again.
Yes. Now, North Korea says it plans to fire missiles towards the U.S. island territory of Guam. And Kim Jong-un says that the president's comment to bring fire and fury against North Korea is a load of nonsense.
Well, it's obviously a question of a very boastful and vain dictator trapped by his own past rhetoric and goading the President of the United States to respond with his own rhetoric, which unfortunately President Trump has done. And essentially, Kim Jong-un is sort of painting himself into a corner, which is a very, very dangerous place for a rat to be. Because in international terms, he really is a rat.
Mm-hmm.
So we just have to hope and pray that President Trump has some kind of strategy that could neutralize or make ineffectual any attempt to drop missiles around Guam. I mean, the high-altitude theater high-altitude defense strategy, which has provided South Korea with missiles that can shoot down incoming intercontinental or intermediate-range missiles. We just have to hope that that is in place so that should these missiles come plopping down in the ocean in the vicinity of Guam, the Americans can show that they can shoot them down in case they were aimed in the future for real cities on land.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to hope there's some response by the United States that can really turn off the spigot of this venom flowing out of Pyongyang.
Mm-hmm. David, do you agree or disagree with the approach President Trump took with his rhetoric?
Well, I'm not in favor of rhetoric, particularly mm-hmm. with someone who is as unpredictable as Kim Jong-un is. And I think, unfortunately, it spikes up the temperature altogether without offering a way out for both sides. So I've heard the argument, well, President Trump is using the sort of the mad leader image that was sometimes attributed to President Nixon by the Vietnamese and other adversaries, and sort of supposedly giving the impression of being so unpredictable that you don't mess with the U.S. Well, that's a good principle in general. We shouldn't be encouraging other people to mess with us in any ways at all.
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of standoff can lead to terrible miscalculations that sometimes in the past have indeed led to war. And the obvious example being the dreadful fallout of rivalry that led to the outbreak of World War I. We certainly don't want to see that happen again.
Right. David, how many presidents go back to talking about the threat of North Korea in your recollection?
I would say, well, it certainly goes back to President Jimmy Carter, President Ford before that, mm-hmm. then Reagan, Clinton, and George W. Bush at least. So we're talking about five presidents at least who have been absolutely perplexed by North Korea, quite unable to come up with a policy that effectively diffuses this tense situation.
Mm-hmm. And does the economic sanctions make a difference in Kim Jong-un's mind?
I think it does. I mean, I think one of the unnoticed plus signs of all this is that the U.S. representative to the U.N., Nikki Haley,
mm-hmm.
did a fabulous job in twisting the arms of both the Russians and the Chinese to come on board, which means that they are obviously very scared with the situation. And the embargo, the sanctions of about $9 billion in exports that North Korea was sending to China really will have an effect if it's allowed to carry on and produce results. So I thought that particular outcome was excellent last week.
Mm-hmm. And then what did you think about President Trump basically calling the regime in North Korea evil?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, because after all, we have to remember that President Reagan referred to an evil empire of the Soviet Union in 1983, I think it was, and he was excoriated by sort of establishment foreign policy observers of the day. They thought he was being belligerent and hostile and so forth, but it was exactly the right terminology to use at that time. And in the event, we won the Cold War because most Russians eventually came to the conclusion that the Soviet regime was indeed evil. I think, unfortunately, we can't have the same effect on the North Korean population because there doesn't seem to be a civic group or a movement in North Korea which is actually advocating a different kind of policy towards the outside world. So although the term is accurate, mm-hmm. unfortunately, I don't think it will have much effect.
Mm-hmm. David, I want to take a very short break, and when I come back, I want to ask you about some of the counsel that President Trump has received from evangelical advisors about his authority and the authority God would give him to do whatever it takes. So I'll ask you that when we return. It's 14 minutes till the top of the hour. I'm speaking to Dr. David Aikman. Be back in a minute. Good morning. 12 minutes until the top of the hour. I have Dr. David Aikman on our studio line with us this morning. We're talking about the events in North Korea and the threats that Kim Jong-un has been making. And there's been advice that the president has been receiving from his evangelical advisors saying, based on what the Book of Romans says, God grants the leaders the authority to use any and all actions to take out evildoers like Kim Jong-un. So let's talk a little bit about being pro-America, and let's talk a little bit about just being pro-gospel.
Do you want me to comment on that?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, of course, the evangelical advisors have made good sense by saying that as, in effect, the appointed, recognized president of the United States, President Trump has the authority to act in accordance with the rules of just war. And these rules are fairly finely calibrated. They include a response to aggression should not be disproportionate to the original aggression, but a response is certainly justified. And if they have given that counsel with the qualification that any decision that involves putting this country at military odds with any foreign adversary is an extremely dangerous situation and should be considered very, very carefully before such a decision is made, I think that is good. But on the other hand, the president needs to be reassured that the basis of his strong evangelical support in the country is backing him up in defending the United States against threats from overseas. So I think they are probably giving him the correct counsel.
Mm-hmm. David, Kim Jong-un is only 33 years old. Was
right.
His dad and grandpa just as nuts in their advanced ages?
Well, totally, yes.
Okay.
I mean, maybe nuts is not quite the right term.
I like the word nuts.
Yeah, of course. Kim Il-sung was basically put in power in North Korea aboard the top of a Soviet tank, which took over the terrain of that country at the end of World War II when the Americans took the surrender of the Japanese in South Korea and the Soviets took it in the North Korea. And then Kim Jong-il was, I think he was really the member of the family who was most nuts. I mean, he did things like kidnapping South Korean actresses and Japanese to come and coach North Korean infiltrators into Japan and so on. I mean, he really did some spooky things, blowing up aircraft and on international flights and so forth. Kim Jong-un seems to be a more steely character, mm-hmm. less flamboyant, perhaps, in his sort of activities, except that we just don't know at what point some of his advisors may hang around him and say, look, chum, don't push the button, because if you do, we're all going to be blown to smithereens. I mean, in a sense, Kim Jong-un is playing Russian roulette, not just with the United States, but with the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the most frightening thing to consider.
David, I think it was U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis issued a pretty dramatic ultimatum to North Korea saying, you need to stop this because you will there will be complete destruction of its people. And I think to myself, does Kim Jong-un even care about his people?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, that's the question, the answer to which we don't know. Does he have any sense of who his people even are? Has he lived with, or has he come to know some of the Koreans who were barely surviving because they can't get enough food to eat? And the Koreans who are sort of dumped into labor camps because they took the dangerous risk of traveling to China to try and find food and jobs and so forth. Does he even have any contact with the basic heart of his own people? And the answer is nobody really knows.
Mm-hmm. So if we use words like fire and fury the world has never seen before, if we use those words, what words can come out next? I really, really mean it.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. The last time was merely rhetorical hyperbole. Now I'm going to talk seriously. I don't know how you parse these things, but without some kind of way to discern what this man's actual sense of reality is, it is very hard to predict both what he will do and how one should respond to that. But I think the Americans are in a position to tailor a response in a fairly sophisticated way, that a response to, let's say, dumping missiles close to Guam does not lead to an all-out attack on North Korea by the United States, because that would undoubtedly precipitate the cataclysm that many of us have feared if the North Koreans were sort of provoked into war with the whole of South Korea.
Mm-hmm. David, we just have less than a couple of minutes to go, so maybe this question is oversimplistic, but exactly what does North Korea want?
North Korea wants respect. It wants to have the world say, yes, we recognize this state is rather poor, but it's very strong. It's developed its own nuclear missile system in spite of the disapproval of most of the world, including its allies. And more than anything else, North Korea wants to be taken seriously by the United States, which really means that in spite of all the insults thrown at America for, you know, 4 or 5 decades, it wants the United States to say, yes, you just spat at me in my eye and I'm wiping the spittle off my face, but okay, we don't really want to invade you or suppress you.
Mm-hmm.
So will you accept the fact that we are a responsible superpower? You may think we are imperialist, but by golly, we want to respect everybody and we don't want a madman throwing nuclear missiles around the world.
Mm. Thank you for bringing so much reason and sanity to this conversation, David. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I have on my bucket list, go to Bray, Ireland, and take David Aikman to dinner.
Well, I would very much enjoy that, and so I hope you don't run out of bucket list objectives before you do that.
I have to take something off the list in order to make room for this, so I'm going to take off Climb, Kilimanjaro. So I'm going to dump that.
Well, Bill, that's great. I hope I could someday climb Mount Kilimanjaro with you.
Maybe we'll do it together. Thanks,
great.
David. Have a great day.
All right. Thanks,
All right,
Bill.
Thanks. Bye. A couple of minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and then come back and wrap up the show. Thanks for listening today. Our verse of the day was Psalm 46, verse 1. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Let me remind you, present help in trouble. Have a great day. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.